Hello and welcome to the Innovation Forum podcast for Friday 25th of October with me, Ian Welsh. Coming up is an interview I recorded in Detroit recently with Kevin Eckerley, Director for Corporate Research and Engagement at the NYU Stern School of Business, who outlines some extensive research into how companies can monetize sustainable business practices. And there's another chance to hear one of our most popular interviews of the year with Ben Vieberg, Director for Sustainability at Bunge Loders Crooklyn, who discusses transparency challenges in palm oil supply chains. All that to come, but first we have the usual roundup of some of what's been happening in business and sustainability. Sportswear brand Adidas is rolling out a new circular economy model that reuses or recycles old or unwanted garments and footwear. Customers can return any items up to 5 years old, no matter the condition, in return for vouchers to purchase new products. The pilot is being trialled at some UK stores, but the brand has plans to expand the project into more markets during 2020. The move is, Adidas says, aiming to help address the growing amount of waste generated by the fashion industry. According to UK waste agency RAP, £140 million worth of clothes end up in landfill in the UK alone every year. Adidas has a history of take-back schemes, having launched one in Brazil in 2012 and Canada in 2016, and then across 9 stores in London, Paris, New York and Los Angeles last year. Fashion watchers think that this new scheme is a real step on for the brand and reflects consumer pressures to tackle the amount of waste the sector generates. Much like the drinks sector's problem with plastic, in a very brand-conscious industry, logo-heavy waste is not a good look. Unilever's Dove brand has tightened its commitments on plastic packaging. It will launch 100% post-consumer waste recycled plastic bottles across its markets in North America and Europe by the end of 2019. It is still not possible, however, to make bottle caps and some other components from post-consumer waste. Dove is also switching soap bars from plastic film wrap to paper-based boxes during 2020 as part of a move to having zero plastic products. The brand is also developing some refillable options for other products. How consumers will react to the changes, ostensibly in a reaction to consumer desires for less plastic waste, will certainly be intriguing. How companies engage with climate and other pressing environmental risks does seem to be in a state of flux, and the Governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, has now warned global companies that unless they agree how to report climate risks in the next couple of years, then they should expect regulators to impose rules on them. Carney was speaking at a meeting held by the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures in Tokyo, where he also said that he sees an increasing willingness by investors to support companies that understand their climate risks. He called on companies to use the next 2 reporting cycles to reach a definitive view as to what counts as high-quality disclosure, and to take care to balance the urgency of the task and the importance of getting it right. That urgency has been underlined by this year's Amazon forest fires, something we've featured in the podcast over the past few months. New Brazilian government data shows how deforestation has climbed, with nearly 60,000 square kilometres of land cleared by fire in the 9 months to the end of September, representing a 97% increase on the same period in 2018, and equivalent to the area cleared in 2017. Not all of this, of course, is primary rainforest. Much of it is made up of pasture, scrub and previously logged forest. The data from Brazil's National Speech Research Institute says that 7,600 square kilometres of forest was chopped down in the year to September, an 86% increase over 2018. Overall, deforestation is on the course to be the highest in over a decade. Whether or not the Amazon as a whole has reached an ecosystem tipping point, moving the region towards a much drier future, remains unclear. But clearly it will be reached soon if rates of tree clearance continue. Next week sees Innovation Forum's Future for Plastics event in Amsterdam on the 30th and 31st of October. It's the biggest yet and will be joined by senior representatives from Reckitt Benckiser, Nestle, Walgreens Boots Alliance, Unilever, Coca-Cola, Plastics Europe and many more. And if you want to join the team, there are still a few passes available. And then on 20th and 21st November in London, we'll be hosting our biggest event of the year, the Sustainable Landscapes and Commodities Forum. Among those already confirmed to join the 350-plus delegates are the key people from Mondelez, Nestle, Golden Agri Resources, IKEA, Greenpeace, World Bank, Consumer Goods Forum and the World Resources Institute. This one is not to be missed and there are still some passes available. Check out the Innovation Forum website and this week's newsletter. And also online now are the first details of Innovation Forum's Spring 2020 conference series, including the next Sustainable Apparel and Textiles Forum in Amsterdam on the 28th and 29th of April. Savings of €400 are available on conference passes right now. When I was in Detroit recently, I sat down with Dr. Kevin Eckerley, Director of Corporate Research and Engagement at NYU Stern School of Business, who explained how the OROSI methodology that he and his colleagues have developed can help companies identify the corporate advantages of a sustainable business approach and to monetize them.
So we've just had a session where you've been giving us the answer we've all been looking for. You've been giving us a methodology that monetizes the benefits of sustainable practices. So why don't you take us through your methodology and how it works?
Sure, be happy to. The premise for our research really begins with the concept that when a business embeds sustainability in its strategy and practice, and for the sake of clarity and definition, when we say embed, what we mean is when a company's sustainability strategy is completely integrated in its corporate strategy. There is no distinction between the two. But when they do that, it drives a number of different business improvements, things like better customer acquisition as well as retention. Better operational efficiency. So the idea concept that we all know so well, which is any form of waste is a cost that can be avoided. So implementing operational efficiency, as well as things like talent and retention. A large number, just about consistently, every sustainability-oriented conference that I've attended over the last several years, at least one, if not multiple companies have called out, this is something that our employees want and is a key differentiator for us in our acquisition of new talent. And so when companies embed sustainability in a strategy and practice, those business aspects are improved. And through that, delivering monetary benefits, either through cost avoidance, increased revenues, improved corporate valuations, likewise being viewed as a less risky investment. As a result, debt and equity costs go down. From the financial improvements, then those companies that are embedding sustainability are delivering both short and long-term value to shareholders, which is a very important stakeholder group, but broader society as well.
So I guess what you're doing is you're providing a methodology or a mechanism for companies to monetize the sort of soft benefits that we've been talking about for ages, really bringing them together and actually showing these are hard benefits.
Right, in our work with corporate partners, a lot of our time is spent putting monetary value on the intangibles. In talking with companies, I continue to hear that those intangibles are a key sticking point, something that keeps companies from really building out a more comprehensive value case, because they can be things that are difficult to monetize. But it's part of our thesis that through reviewing academic and industry literature that puts an estimate on these values, or at least provides us with data points that we can use and put into equation to help us monetize those intangibles, we can make the intangible tangible.
Well, that sounds great. Give us an example of it in practice.
So a recent example would be work what we did with a Canadian utility. They are an electricity generator. They are facing a 2030 mandate to get off coal, so no longer use coal in the generation fleet. And the question that they presented to us was, what could be the potential value of taking a more accelerated pace and being more aggressive, launching a more ambitious sustainability agenda? Through our work with them and applying our process and our methodology, we generated a monetary estimate for things like the value of reduction in cost of equity and cost of debt. As I said earlier, one of the key pieces, and it's been shown through some work by Arabesque, where across a variety of the companies, they do demonstrate or do document an improvement in their cost of debt and cost of equity because they're viewed as a less risky investment. So we were able to put an estimate on the monetary value that can be created through that mechanism. Similarly, we looked at reduction in turnover costs, reduction in turnover as a result of being more sustainable and launching a more ambitious sustainability agenda.
You mean employee turnover, not company
employee
turnover?
Employee turnover, yes, employee turnover. Thank you. But in addition, we also looked at the potential value through being more competitive in the marketplace. Many large corporate buyers, like big tech companies, are making commitments, rather ambitious commitments, to be 100% powered by renewable electricity. By launching a more ambitious sustainability agenda and increasing clean energy in their generation fleet, we put an estimate on the value that can be accrued through being more competitive and earning a higher rate of contracts, earning new contracts at a faster rate by being more ambitious with their sustainability agenda. And so we were able to put monetary value estimates to each of those things and presented that to their C-suite team. And while their CFO questioned the actual numbers, through our process and talking through our process, his comments to us were, that makes sense. That is a sound logic, and I understand the logic and the process. Even though I may argue with the specific numbers, as the CFO of this company, I know where the right numbers sit. And I can put our team together and organize our team to go find and put into your equations the right numbers. So it was something where, by our work with them, they've reconsidered their ambition to sustainability and are getting more aggressive on the sustainability front.
Did you give them options in terms of, well, if you say switch to gas, this will achieve these sort of benefits, but if you actually come out of fossil fuels entirely, you'll achieve these sort of benefits?
In this specific case, we didn't really present those sorts of options. There were different levels of ambition, sort of what is the additive benefits as you go through. But for the most part, we didn't really present options. We've done that with other corporate partners. What are the costs and benefits of business as usual? What are the additive benefits of, say, for instance, greenhouse gas emissions? Taking a more moderate approach, say 1.5% reduction annually, versus a more ambitious or science-based target approach. Mm-hmm. We've given different options, worked that way with other partners, but not in this business.
How do you determine in your methodology, I mean, working these things, the kind of definite cause and effect? How do you work through making this particular action will lead to that, definitely to that particular outcome?
In working with individual partners, it can be a more case-by-case basis. In some instances, we do cross-industry collaborations. So we've done that in the automotive and are currently doing it in the fashion industries. And so in those cases, because we're doing more, what's the value of sustainability to us as a brand, it can get a little difficult to get down to a real granular level of cause and effect, though that's what we are trying to do. So as part of our process, we're conducting surveys and interviews with C-suite level executives, leaders in the business, to understand how exactly are you addressing the risks, addressing the opportunities? What are the specific actions you're taking? We're reviewing their sustainability strategy in detail so we can get a good understanding of exactly how you as a business are approaching sustainability and are looking to mitigate the risks and grow opportunities. But because we're doing a corporate valuation, it can be a bit challenging to get to that level of cause and effect. When we do more one-on-one consulting type arrangements working with corporate partners, we can get more granular, we can go deeper. And as a result, we can get closer to that level of cause and effect as part of our process.
Okay. You're trying to monetize issues that previously haven't been monetized properly or haven't been monetized effectively. Therefore, there must be a concern that you don't have the right data points. So when you don't have the right data points, how do you then work in the sort of things like, for example, the value of retaining an employee? It's hard to get to really nail that down. I mean, there are kind of, you can think, well, there's some issues with your HR costs, you can argue. But how do you nail down the cost or the value of retention of employees, for example?
Part of our process is working with companies to identify, first build the equation, and identify the data points that go into the equation. And so ideally, in our work with corporate partners, they have the existing data. So for many companies, they have, okay, here's our current turnover rate. Here is the cost of turnover. What they may not have, however, is how their actions on sustainability have impacted turnover rate. So in those instances where we don't have the ideal data point, we go outside the company that we're working with, looking for correlates or similar data points, either from at the start would be companies within the same industry. And then in the absence of those sort of data points, we look across industry or other studies. And as much as we can, try to build up in our library data points from a variety of sources so that rather than rely on a single data point, we can look on broad averages. And so when we are, say for instance, estimating the value of improved employee retention as a result of sustainability, we can include here's our assumption and document that assumption. In our work with corporate partners then, once we establish that initial estimate, it's engaging finance teams, engaging their HR team to say, here's the equation, here's the logic behind the equation, here are the data points that feed that equation, and here's the outcome. How does that resonate with you? Is that conclusion defensible? In cases where they may question it, understanding from them what their challenges are and finding a middle ground that's acceptable. Now, we are embarking on a project with a corporate partner to get into this employee engagement more specifically. And so look forward to reporting on some of those outcomes in the near future.
Sure, well, we'll look forward to that. It's all fascinating stuff. I didn't mention at the beginning, it's the Return on Sustainability Investment approach from the NYU Stern School of Business. But Dr. Kevin Eckerle, thank you very much indeed for taking us through today.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
Earlier this year, I spoke with Ben Vreeburg, Director of Sustainability at Bunge Loker's Crooklyn, and we talked about sustainability challenges in palm oil supply chains.
Ben, why don't you start off by giving us a bit of background to your business, what you do, who you work with, and where you are in the, particularly in the palm oil industry.
All right. Well, as you said, I work for Bunge/Bunge Loker's Crooklyn, and I look after the sustainability aspects of the tropical oils that we source. Bunge, the large oils and grain trader processor. We source palm, soy, sun, canola, wheat, and we process that for our customers further downstream. And we have a global presence with operation facilities across the globe in all the continents, so we're able to serve our customers efficiently.
Well, thank you very much for that. We're going to talk to the specifically about your palm oil business. In terms of thinking about your palm oil, in terms of transparency, a big thing, of course, for many commodity supply chains. But in palm oil, you've achieved 93% transparency to the mill for your palm oil supply chain. So what's been the principal challenges of getting to that level? And what are the barriers to getting to 100% traceability?
Well, I think we are a bit higher than the 93. We're probably at 96, 97. There are always a couple of shipments that report in late with the traceability number, so that why we sometimes lack the remaining 2, 3%. But we have full visibility on where we source our oil from back to mill level. It used to be a big challenge 4 or 5 years ago when everybody was very scared to disclose mill information. These days, I think any company that sources palm oil has their own mill list published online. Quite a big administrative exercise. Not always sure what sort of value that adds if downstream retailers publish a mill list of 1,000 mills. But anyway, that's the way it goes, and transparency is there. The next challenge, obviously, is to move one step further upstream to the plantations. And that will be a challenge. And we also have to rethink if we want to end up with endless lists of plantations and coordinates, including smallholders, or there are other ways to do it much more efficient, while at the same time addressing the concerns of our stakeholders in terms of where the oil is coming from and how it's been verified to be compliant to the policies that we all have.
So what you're seeing then is that the levels of transparency in supply chains have been an industry-wide move then?
It is. And I've always wondered why it took us together so long to come with a universal mill list that is now available through Utz and Global Forest Watch, because we're all sourcing from the same set of mills at some point.
Big changes at the Roundtable for Sustainable Palm Oil in the revised principles and criteria in the last year. A lot of attention. How are they being implemented in practice so far?
A bit early to say, because the principle and criteria first had to be accepted, which happened at the General Assembly in November last year in Kota Kinabalu. That was obviously a great achievement. The next step is to get all the certification bodies trained in how to verify, and also the plantation companies to review the principles and criteria and implement these on their plantations. Fortunately, many plantation companies have already made commitments and implemented commitments that were beyond the old RPO-PNC. So there are several companies that shouldn't have too much difficulty in implementing the new ones. But in terms of having the oil available on the market, that's too early. It will probably take 6 to 12 months from the day that the principles and criteria were accepted.
How far were the new principles and criteria, in your view, the RSPO catching up? And how much are they actually taking the industry forward?
I think in terms of commitments of the big grower companies and the big brands, you could say they're catching up. But I think they're all converting now towards the same set of principles and criteria. And it's good that the RSPO is doing that. While at the same time, there's still a large volume of oil that is not yet even certified by the old principles and criteria. So there's always a risk of RSPO running too far ahead of the pack and losing a lot of potential RSPO members and oil that could be certified. But the standard that they have now accepted, I think, and you can always argue about some elements, and I know some stakeholders will argue about the credibility again, but the set of criteria that has been developed and accepted is well at par with the market expectations. I think the challenge is now that the market accepts these and starts buying these wholeheartedly in all their operations across the globe.
How far do you feel that the RSPO changes reflect an industry-wide desire to develop properly sustainable supply chains? I mean, do you think that there's been a bit of a game change in terms of everybody moving in that direction?
I'm not sure if it's a game changer, because I think the game has already changed. But it's the only system available that has specifically laid out principles and criteria, has set up a certification system and body and organization behind it that is able to do independent verification. And yes, you can continue to question the credibility of that, but there is no other system out there. Even individual companies lack resources and independency to verify their own volumes that they source. We all need independent verification bodies, and this is all in place. So I think the real game changer would be that the market now sort of convenes back to RSPO and accept that as the standard and as the system, because what I see is that individual companies or sets of companies are developing similar systems and similar processes, and it's all there. So rather than criticizing one, we could also use all that energy to build on that one system that is now out there and that has accepted principles and criteria that are with market expectations.
Are there elements of reinventing the wheel then, when people could just use the RSPO's principles and criteria, but in fact are developing similar separate systems?
I think so. And because ultimately, the people I talk to want independent verification. Well, that is available within the RSPO setting. They want an NDPE supply chain. And with the new principles and criteria, these elements are covered. So it's all out there. And I've been in the palm business for quite a while, but on the sustainability side for the last 5 years. And I've seen lots of arguments and fights and challenges and campaigns. I think it's time now to get behind the system and make it work rather than trying to reinvent the wheel and all do our individual or group-wise new sure. inventions that ultimately end up in the same place.
Do you think that the RSPO is best seen, or RSPO certification best seen as a sort of stepping stone on the way to best practice, or is it now the kind of gold standard?
I don't think it's the gold standard. I have a sign behind my desk that says we are on a journey, and as we move forward, we will come to new insights and have new challenges. So any system will be a stepping stone, but it would be very helpful if we would all step on that stone rather than trying to avoid that step.
In the past, RSPO was heavily criticized for not properly implementing its previous standards. What evidence are you seeing that the new ones are going to be enforced more effectively?
I think that that is a fair criticism. RSPO is growing, and I think RSPO can do also a bit more in terms of professionalizing its organization or the partners that it works with, because the stakes are rather high. So it is important that RSPO grows with the stakeholder demands. Am I seeing evidence that it's moving in that direction? Yes, RSPO is investing a lot in strengthening their organization, but I think that they can do more, as we can do more in implementing our policies. And that is key for other stakeholders to accept RSPO as the stepping stone. And therefore, it doesn't work if you continue to campaign against RSPO, but rather use that energy to support RSPO and help RSPO to become stronger.
Thinking more generally, how do you find the balance when you're dealing with your suppliers between suspending relationships, as I know you did last year, suspending relationships with your suppliers or working with them to improve their own sustainability, their own impact? How do you get that balance? It must be very difficult.
Well, we take the approach that we always want to work with our suppliers. And if we identify gaps or if we identify non-compliances, we always check and verify and allow our suppliers to comment on it and to stop what they're doing. That's explicitly stated in our policy that if we detect, for instance, deforestation, we require our suppliers to immediately cease that development. But if they don't, of course, then we have to move towards suspension, or if the supplier is unwilling to collaborate, then we have no alternative than to suspend that supplier. But often suppliers are collaborative. It requires a fair bit of discussion and meetings. But if the attitude is right and the willingness is there, then our preferred option is to work and support our suppliers towards compliance rather than suspension. But as you said, we've suspended some suppliers in the past. There were obvious reasons for that, but always based on fact-finding, verification, and allowing the supplier to commit. But if that's not there, or to stop. But if they don't, and we continue to see that, for instance, clearing happens without any assessments, it's a no-brainer.
Thinking in terms, then, of the future, what are the remaining challenges that you're seeing for the palm oil sector? What would be the next big step forwards?
I think the next big step is more the way we collaborate with all the stakeholders rather than trying to invent new principles and criteria or to raise the bar even further. It's more about implementing what we have committed ourselves to as a sector, but also how we collaborate. I think NGOs are pushing companies to change their business model, and I think businesses have to change their model. It shouldn't only be based on hard financial targets and incentives. There is much more non-financial value that is added in supply chains that should be discussed. And businesses are changing their models and are changing the way they operate. They are also concerned about the impact they're having upstream in the supply chain and the community. So there's a lot happening. But at the same time, I think NGOs should also change their business model. It's all too easy to campaign on individual companies for the sake of attracting funds or for making a point. And you will always find cases that are not good. But I think here it's more how to focus on the things that are going well, how to support systems or groups of companies that are trying to do the right things right and give positive attention rather than to continue to find the negatives and focus on that. So we all have a responsibility here, all stakeholders involved. And I think the challenge is if we can find that common ground and work collectively, we can move forward from challenge to challenge.
What about climate resilience? What sort of levels of concern do you have as a business and as a sector, more generally in terms of where palm oil will be grown in the future as you know, climate change takes hold?
That's a good question, a tough one to ask. There is a growing population that needs to be fed. And I think it's not just about zooming in on one commodity and how that commodity can become climate resilient, and they have to. It's also about consumer behavior and the way we consume things. We have to change our businesses, but we also have to change our consumption patterns. We cannot continue to consume the way we are. I think palm oil is too small to be the only one that can be responsible for the climate change.
Some retailers have been announcing banning palm oil in certain products and everything else. But in fact, that in itself has unintended consequences when palm oil is such an efficient oil to be used in so many different ways.
Absolutely.
Do you think that the climate resilience debate may in fact mean that palm oil loses a lot of the negative connotations?
I think it does, because if you as a supermarket ban palm oil, you're replacing the palm oil with other oils that require much more land to produce the same amount of oil. You cannot single out one component, and another element is the value you add on it. If we are so concerned about the forests in Indonesia and in Brazil, then it's about time we put some value on it and work out mechanisms that has to be at government level, whether we like it or not, to preserve and conserve those forests that are the lungs of the earth and find other ways for those countries to develop their economy or their communities and keep the forest standing. I think we need to put much more emphasis on that rather than, and I come back on that, singling out a commodity and criticize it for things that is also taking place in other commodities. And that has to change. And that is something that stakeholders need to address as well.
Like so many things, when you're talking about resilience to climate change and developing more sustainable supply chains, it's always a bit more complicated than you think. Every time you uncover the one layer, there's always more complications underneath.
And to that point, Ian, and I can go on this a fair bit, but in 1960, an average Dutchman would spend 40% of his net income on food. Today, it's 11%. So we got 90% of our net income to spend on other things that are equally unsustainable or probably even more unsustainable. And you cannot deny that. You cannot talk about improving the sustainability of a commodity without talking about the value that sustainable practices have for people.
So it's a much broader, it has to be an all-encompassing, holistic approach.
I mean,
approach these things.
I've been on the sales side and I've had many discussions with customers about the sustainable practices, but also on pricing. When you go to supermarkets, when you put on your television, it's all about the lowest price this, or if you can get it cheaper elsewhere, we'll pay it back. It's never about the other values that contributed to products. And that has to change, because if that doesn't change, it will be an uphill battle.
So perhaps that is the final remaining challenge, not just for the palm oil sector, but beyond, is really developing better value chains that value everything appropriately rather than just valuing some things and not others.
Exactly.
Ben Vreeburg from Bunge Lugers Crookland, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ian.
And don't forget, you can carry on the discussion about palm oil and other commodities supply chains in London next month at the Sustainable Landscapes and Commodities Conference. But that's all for now. I'm Ian Welsh, and I'll be back next week.